Welcome back to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. I'm Eric Paul, and I'm being joined today by a fellow educator, Mike Thompson, who is, and we were just talking for a long time before this, a lifelong gamer, but specifically the open world concept. I know there's a lot of abbreviations, Mike, but what is the one that is the go-to to distinguish the kind of games we're going to talk about tonight from the other ones?
Yeah, so typically they're called MMOs, MMORPGs, so massive multiplayer online games, massive multiplayer online role-playing games is another term for them.
So, you know, I was thinking about this, and just moments ago you said it, and I'm like, that's exactly where I was too. Like, I grew up playing video games. You and I are not too far apart in age, and all through the 80s into the 90s, you know, Nintendo turned into Sega Genesis, which turned into PlayStation and everything. But it seemed like each iteration of video games that came out, there was, I just kept thinking to myself, I wish I could go into the horizon on these games. Like, I remember Pole Position, playing Pole Position on the Atari 7800 and seeing this background that looked like a fairground or something like that. I'm like, if I just kept driving, could I go see that? Like, could I just like drive around? Like, I'll lose the race. I'm fine with that. I just want to see, you know, what kind of, and of course you just blow up, which doesn't actually happen in racing as much as Pole Position made it seem like, but you know, you just like, and then so finally, I remember, I think it must have been the original PlayStation that they had some game, which was exactly that. They're like, just go exploring, go see what's out there. I'm like, that looks great. And I would gladly spend hours just exploring. Sure. Is that where you were too with games?
Yeah. I mean, you're close, right? Like, so that sort of open world concept game, actually, yeah, the first one that I remember was a game called Final Fantasy One, which launched this huge franchise. And that was the first one that had anything resembling an open world. Before that, it was like your Pac-Man and your Pole Position and all of those sorts of games. But then, so this was still an unconnected world, right? Like, if I wanted to play video games with a friend, it would either be me going over to their house or them coming over to my house. And then the PlayStation, you started the PlayStation, I think the PlayStation 1 really focused on that more sandboxy open world kind of concept. We had some Final Fantasy games. We had Final Fantasy 7, which was huge. We had Final Fantasy 8, which was huge. Mm. Then 9 and 10, which less huge, and there were a bunch of games that came out around that time. And what it came down to, I think, is as the technology evolved, we could spend more time in a game. Like, a cartridge, an Atari cartridge, could only hold so much information, and that's not much. And then CDs could hold more, like that.
And so as the tech got more sleek and more capable, then so did the idea factory among the creators. Because I could be pretty sure that, I mean, you were mentioning before we hit record about Minneapolis, and I did an episode last year about learning about the Oregon Trail game, and that actually started in Minneapolis. It was a concept of a social studies teacher who wanted to have basically a choose your own adventure type thing when it came to teach about westward expansion. And it just so happened IBM is there, and you know, it's a pretty tech heavy city, at least in the 60s. And one thing led to another, and that eventually did turn into the first real game for the Apple IIe was Oregon Trail, when it finally, because originally it was just on cards. It wasn't even really on a computer screen, but then when it turned into computers. And so it's like that has some, not quite open worldism, because it's specific to a particular trail from history. You can't go too much off of it, but having choice and knowing that every time you play, it's going to be a little bit different than the previous time. I can imagine that game developers and, you know, if somebody's like 10 years old in 1982 playing Oregon Trail, then they turn by the time you get to 2000, the year 2000, we're talking they're in their 30s and they're probably pursuing that career, and they're trying to bring to reality what they were initially, you know, inspired by. So Oh, so we're going to talk about two games kind of back and forth. One is EVE Online and the other is World of Warcraft. I'm more familiar with World of Warcraft because a friend of mine would play it pretty frequently. And he would let me play some, but he had his own thing going on. So I would just, I would just watch. And I was glad to do it because it was like watching a never ending movie, really. And, EVE, on the other hand, I'm not so familiar with that, but that seems to be just as, if not bigger, than World of Warcraft. When did you get involved in these games?
Yeah, so for me, it was 2006. So EVE Online came out in 2003 with its open beta. And it actually launched in 2003 as well. It just celebrated its 20th anniversary, which is pretty impressive. I was talking to a friend of mine, and this was 06 by the time I got involved. He was a big World of Warcraft player, and he was talking to me about it, and I was like, I don't know, man. Like, yeah, I played D&D growing up and all that, and it's fun, but I just really don't really feeling World of Warcraft right now. And he goes, well, you know, I heard about this other game called EVE Online. And I was like, well, what's that? And he goes, well, it's spaceships. And I went, really? Well, that's interesting. then he told me this story. In the early days of EVE Online, there was this group, and they were called the Guiding Hand Social Club. And EVE Online, so all of these massive multiplayer online games have different levels of organization for players. So you can join guilds in a lot of games. EVE Online calls them corporations and alliances and all of these things. And one of the big sort of things about EVE is that it's a truly open world. It is not narrative driven like World of Warcraft. World of Warcraft, there's a story. Right. You log into that game, you start playing at level one, and it tells you a story, and you can follow the path the whole way, and you get a new quest, and they say, hey, go do this thing, and then you turn it in, and so on and so forth. Well, EVE Online, when I started playing it, you download the game, you spend all this time in creating what your character looks like and their background and all these things. And then they drop you into the middle of space in a spaceship while you're being shot. With no tutorial. When I got in, there was no tutorial. Now, that has, of course, evolved considerably in the last 20 years. But there was this thing called the Guiding Hand Social Club. And this Guiding Hand Social Club, there was one group of people, real players, who infiltrated the organization of another group and stole all their stuff.
Oh, geez.
And I was like, wait a minute, and they didn't get kicked out of the game? And they're like, no. In EVE Online, you don't get kicked out for, you know, shooting people, taking their stuff, any of that. It's encouraged. It's part of the game. And I went, oh, my goodness. So you're telling me not only do I get to be a spaceship pilot, but I get to be a spy too?
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't get better than that.
Right. It's like living out fantasies.
Oh, yeah.
Every time you've watched, in this case, like a science fiction movie or a fantasy movie, you're like, yeah, I would love to be in that world and not have to.
For sure. Or it's that, for me, there was this movie that came out. I don't remember. It was mid-80s, right? Called The Last Starfighter.
Yes.
Yeah, right. The premise of The Last Starfighter is what's kept me playing video games my whole life. So The Last Starfighter, right, there's this dude, and he's playing an arcade game, and he gets the top score, and all of a sudden it's like this message. It's like, hey, you're now we need your help, pilot. And he just gets recruited by these advanced aliens to go do this spaceship war. And it's like, oh my god, that's the best thing ever.
Because it turns out it's like a training platform, right?
Yeah, it's a training and recruitment platform.
Like, oh yeah, we're gonna plant these all around the galaxy and see who's good at it.
See who rocks it out.
I remember that movie vividly because I remember the spaceship in that looked kind of like it was very like cylindrical, and I remember I had a mold, you know, for sandcastle building that looked pretty much like it. And so I'm like, well, I just have the toy right here. I'm just going to play Last Starfighter, you know, in my backyard with this toy.
Yeah.
listening to this podcast for the first time, welcome. And the way we cover pop culture in here, in media, is like we would do in a museum or some kind of classroom where you're learning about history, we're analyzing it. And the first question I'm going to bring up today is what material is it made from? And you've already gone over that. Now, one of the big difference between, and it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, EVE Online versus World of Warcraft is World of Warcraft already had about a decade of material
ahead. For sure.
Of that, and I remember playing Warcraft, the original game, or some variation of it, at my friend's house when I was in early high school or so, and I loved it. I thought it was just great, this whole idea of being able to, you know, true RPG game, where you could, you know, you start with really nothing, and you build up your fortifications, and you train people, and you get better guys, and you eventually fight other people's bases. And honestly, those games were a lot of fun. I found them very suspenseful, because you could be minding your own business, and if you focus too much on one job, you're like, I'm going to cut down all these trees over here. And next thing you know, there's a dragon, and he's burning down your, you know, little hut or whatever. And you're like, oh man, I didn't pay attention to that. And that seemed to spawn a whole bunch of other games just like it. I mean, I remember playing Star Wars one for a while. It wasn't Battlefront. It was called Battlefield, I think. That was a lot of fun. There was
it invented
StarCraft.
It invented the genre known as the real-time strategy, as far as I'm aware.
More that, not so much RPG, but real-time strategy. And those games were super, super popular. People were using them. And, of course, we have to distinguish those are on computers. So computer gaming seems to have a different plateau of existence than regular video gaming.
Going to the what is it made from, actually, EVE Online, it's unique in a couple of ways. The first way it's unique, so World of Warcraft that you mentioned has a multitude of servers. Lots and lots and lots of them. And so you join the game and you pick a server. And that's the server you're in. And each server has usually, at least at the time when I played it, which would have been like 08 or something like that, it had maybe 1,000 people. But two things from a tech level. So I'm a tech teacher. So the two things from the standpoint of technology, what's it made from, is that EVE Online is on just one server for the main game. There's another server for China because of their regulations around online connectivity. But so there's one server. So if you and I play EVE Online, we're both on the same server. Mm. They use a shard technology, which I won't go into here. But so it's one server, but it's also when they made EVE Online, the foundation, the base of EVE Online is actually a database, which is not the truth for most video games. So what's it made from? It's made from one server in a database, which is nobody else has done, or at least certainly then, and not really now either.
What was that? I imagine that was revolutionary for the time then, right? That they weren't.
It was.
You know, and I would say both games are revolutionary in their own way.
Certainly.
But it seems like EVE, and so it's like when you know, another things I think about with World of Warcraft versus, you know, that's the one I'm more familiar with is when it comes to material, is that, you know, they have their own original story, but things like elves and paladins and orcs and all, I mean, pretty much every high fantasy story since, you know, the Lord of the Rings has had those kinds of
elves,
characters,
and dwarves, and orcs.
They're all, they're already there. And so it wasn't super hyper original. Online seems to have gone the other way, right? They're like 30,000 years in the future. So they're not even worried about anybody touching. It's like we're making our completely own stuff. Like nobody is not even inspired by.
For sure. For sure. Else. They did pull some inspiration from a couple of earlier sci-fi games, one called Elite, which was, you know, a spaceship flying game. Origins, I think, was another one. There were a couple of open world-ish sci-fi ones, but certainly one could argue that Ultima Online, Bagat EverQuest, Bagat World of Warcraft. But you could not say the same for EVE Online. Mm-hmm. Right? You can certainly point to inspiration, but nobody, as far as I know, right? I'm certainly not the world's foremost expert on spaceship video games, but as far as I know, nobody did anything close before. It was completely revolutionary.
Do you think that, because I'm thinking in that time period, you know, we're, it's 2004, so we're like, we have 5 out of 9 Star Wars movies already out.
Yeah.
You know, and another one's on its way. You know, the episode 3 was going to be coming out, and you had, of course, a lot of Star Trek. I guess what I'm getting at is like space, like the ideas behind what spaceships look like and how people interact in outer space with each other. Mm-hmm. There had been some kind of basis for that. And having never played the game at all, did you see in any of the designs of the ships or the vernacular any relationship to science fiction or fantasy space-based stuff, or does it seem very, very original?
So, at the time, to me, I'd never seen anything remotely like it.
Okay.
At the time, my experience with even sci-fi was limited to Star Wars and Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And this, I hadn't actually read much in terms of sci-fi. I read a lot of fantasy, but not much sci-fi. Later, I can see where they pulled some of the ways that they run the game. I feel like they're heavily influenced by, I believe it's David Weber's work with the Honor Harrington series, and just different sci-fi. Like sci-fi seemed really niche at the time.
Yeah.
If it wasn't Star Wars or Star Trek, most people didn't know about it.
Right.
Even you know. Nerds like me just didn't know about it. We'd, you know, when I saw this game and I thought what I thought was going to happen was I was going to log in and I was going to be walked through a story, an open world story, but a story similar to like Colony Wars, Colony Wars 2, mm-hmm. those sorts of video games from the PlayStation where you actually flew your spaceship. And then I get into EVE and it's more, it's not that I'm not, you know, I'm not moving a throttle and a joystick in EVE. I'm giving commands to my crew, and they're doing things.
Has it always been free to play that?
No. So they always had some sort of a trial. What was interesting, though, is they were the first game that I am aware of that actually you didn't have to buy a physical disc. You could initially, but by the time I rolled around, you just downloaded it. Mm-hmm. You went to their website and downloaded it. There are a couple of good documentaries on, you know, the game and how it worked. One was called Down the Rabbit Hole that is a YouTube thing that came out not too long ago. And they'll talk about the fact that so when EVE Online, the Crowd Control Productions, the developer, they had an initial run of these discs because that's how you got video games. But it was through, and I don't remember specifically. I want to say Houghton Mifflin or Palladium, one of the large.
I think it was Simon and Schuster.
Simon and Schuster, that's the one. Yeah, you got it. Simon and Schuster, they published books and they did a software thing and they got a deal with EVE Online and then.
I'm just cracking up because Simon and Schuster just sounds like, you know, the picture that goes along with them is like, I think it's like some guy with like a schoolboy with his books or something.
Right.
It sounds like it's so 19th century.
Sure.
And then to be with this super sleek name, all it is EVE, you know, and it doesn't even look like an E. It's just like 3 lines. And
yeah,
it's like, it's just so funny when those kinds of things pair up with each other, you know.
And it's wild because then they started being a software distributor and then almost immediately stopped being a software distributor. So the developer had to figure out, okay, how are we going to get this in the hands of people? And it was internet speeds, right? So this was This was an 8-hour download.
Yeah.
I mean, that
easily, yeah.
It took 8 hours to get this game onto your computer. It was ridiculous.
What I'm reading into this and what I'm, kind of pulling from this is it's, looking back 20 years ago, that was such a, I guess the internet's always been evolving. It's always been ever since sure. It started. But there seems to be plateaus of time where it's like everybody, because they can't develop it too fast. They can't, right. Just get like no more CDs, everybody. It's yeah. like they kind of like, wean us off of the different mm-hmm. things. Like even the traditional USB port is on its way out. It's being replaced
sure.
by the C one, and that's going to be replaced at some point. But they can't do it too fast. But I feel like in that early 2000s period, there was a lot of possibilities of which direction we're going to go. And mm-hmm. it was a roll of the dice as to which way is going to be the most advanced form of computers. And I guess ultimately the fact that there were people who were willing to and able to buy machines, computers specifically made for gaming.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the Alien.
Alienware. This was before Alienware, though.
Okay, so that probably came as a result of these kinds of games.
Probably
where it was like that tells us something about the society at the time, that there were people
yeah.
that these kinds of games were so important to them, and we'll talk about that in just a few moments. But it was so important to them that they were willing to. We're talking about down economy too. Like the early 2000s was not a good time for, it got worse actually by the end of the decade, but coming off of 9/11, there was a pretty significant drop in people's budgets and finances and stuff like that. And I guess the target audience was probably young, like teenage men, young men, through like early late 20s or so.
For sure.
And so they would find the way to get up the money to, to pay for this or to have the computer at least that could keep up with the game.
Well, and I think one of the parts of that, right, is that the economy wasn't fantastic, but that was when Dell had won. Right. So there was a time before that when it was Dell, HP, and Compaq competing for that home desktop market. IBM had already exited the space.
Yeah.
And by the early 2000s, Dell had effectively won that game. And so home computers, it was, I think, $2,500, but that was half what it was just 4 years before. And a gaming computer didn't exist. So what you would do is you would look for, a computer that was advertised as being designed for graphic design. If you weren't building your own out of components, which was beyond me at the time, but you would look for a graphic design computer because it had the highest end graphic cards available at the time.
There was definitely a gearhead component to computers back then. I recall, I was in college or just about to leave college around that time. But, right around the time I went to school in 99, 2000, I remember going to a computer store with some friends. And they knew a bit more than I did about computers. So they were talking tech and I had no idea what they're talking about. But hearing them talk shop with the people working at these places and then having aisles that just had the different components that you would need.
Sure.
And even, and it was almost like when I went to their dorm rooms and stuff, it almost seemed like they were like building motorcycles. I remember the big towers and something back then, the bigger the tower, it was actually a good thing.
Yeah.
And like with a window and you could see it inside and showing it off like you would so total status symbol type thing. And if you could, use your game, and play these games, if your computer could even handle the kinds of speeds that you needed to do this kind of thing. That was, for young men in particular, it was really a status symbol kind of thing.
Oh, definitely.
What you're able to do. to take a step back just for a minute, because we were talking about Simon & Schuster, but before that we said Crowd Control is the name of the
Crowd Control Productions.
So they made it. What was their? Were they a startup around that time? Because Blizzard had been around for a while. They were supposed to do World of Warcraft, and they had been established quite a bit earlier. Was this company that made Eve? Were they newcomers?
Sort of. So it's an Icelandic company, which is pretty weird. Anyway, and they had been doing some work, and I only recently found this out when I watched the documentary I mentioned, but they had done some work on a really, really early version of what we now know as Second Life, where you had an avatar and it could do all these things online. And they said, hey, what if we could wrap some spaceships on this thing and make a real game out of it. So they'd all done some work on that project, but they were all former employees of a company that did that. Crowd Control Productions, who made it, that was not this was their first and only product, right?
Oh, really?
Was Eve Online. I heard a tale that they came that in order to get some funding in order to build the game, they actually made a board game and sold a board game to get some of their initial funding, which I think is interesting. But yeah, they hadn't done anything, and they actually kind of struggled to get funding because it's like, okay, you want to how do I control my spaceship? Like, what do you mean I don't control my spaceship? Right. What's the story? Oh, wait, you mean there's no story? Wait, the players do the whole thing? What is this? I mean, this is before, Grand Theft Auto 3 or whatever it was. This is before there was anything resembling. I mean, even World of Warcraft didn't come out until a year later. So they were a startup.
And so did they have that name, Crowd Control, before they, as they were conceptualizing the game? Because I'm wondering if there's any kind of secret, not much of a secret, but a message through the name Crowd Control that they are.
So I believe it had something to do with that sort of Second Life kind of stuff that they did before. It was Crowd Control Productions or something like that. The company they all worked for in Iceland was defunct at that point. So they had to start their own. But I believe it had something to do with just hearkening back to that idea of the sort of Second Life kind of game.
Yeah. Well, and that brings me to, I think, a pretty important one. What ideas and behavior does this convey? And I think that this kind of thing, you mentioned Dungeons and Dragons before, back in the 70s and definitely the 80s when D&D was getting super popular, it was finding its way into public attention, not always positively. Parent groups in particular, and church groups were really nervous about satanic messages that might be sent through these things, or kids taking the game way too seriously, and going off the deep end with whatever it is, the message they would get through the game or their missions and stuff like that. But it seems like with the huge popularity of both these games, that by and large, those kinds of outcrying was So I guess there's two ways of looking at these games, either as, like I said, crowd control, like these people are going to be controlled by the game, that even when they're among real people, they're going to be thinking about their alter ego on these games.
Which is true with EVE Online.
But then the other side of it is it actually meeting a need for a lot of people to have an alter ego?
So one of the main sort of themes of EVE Online is treating your fellow players poorly in the context of the game is not only allowed but encouraged. At the same time, some random person is flying through a part in space and you go blow up their ship and it ruins their day, and that's great. That's part of the fun. But at the same time, there have been many instances where, so with EVE Online, there's very definitely part of the culture is this separation between who you play in the game and who you are in the real world.
Everything is a Primary Source is building a digital archive, and you can get involved. Perhaps you would like to add to this conversation, or start a new one about history through pop culture. Go to everything-history.com to learn about the Everything is a Primary Source project and how you can take part in this exciting, new, open-source educational resource.
And one of the most amazing thing, couple of most amazing things about EVE Online. First is that there is an in-game channel that's called Broadcast for Reps. Reps being repairs. So if you're in a fleet, there are certain ships that their whole job is to fix your ship as it's getting attacked. And this whole in-game channel called Broadcast for Reps was requested by the players and implemented by the developers as a in-game suicide hotline.
Oh my goodness.
Hey, I'm having a bad day. I can go to Broadcast for Reps, right? And Broadcast for Reps, there are going to be people there who will engage with me and who will, you know, tell me it's okay. And they will actively make my game experience better. They'll be like, oh, hey, are you having a bad day because you got your ship blown up? Here's a bunch of in-game currency. Can I help you? Right? This sort of thing. The other thing that I think is just, it's just beautiful is the players. You know, a game that has this many players over the course of this length of time, there are a lot of people who played the game and built relationships within the game who are no longer with us, who passed away. And the players began by organizing this one system. So if your ship gets exploded in game, you're put into a pod. And then if your pod gets exploded, then a corpse is floating in space.
Oh, geez.
But where it becomes beautiful is some people who've passed away, they'll take that corpse and they'll bring it to a certain system. And before the developers even got involved, they would put the corpse in this system and then nobody else would touch it. They would just leave it alone. The developers then added as a feature and made it permanent. But it's this in-game memorial for everyone who they know about who's passed away. And in the groups, if someone passes away, we do this thing called Beacons of Hope, which there's a certain piece of equipment that you can get that is called a Sinusoidal Beacon. And everybody who knows this player, this character or this player, will go to a certain place and they'll light up this Sinusoidal Beacon, and it's this all this light and everything. And it's just, there are some really... It's a game that encourages you to treat each other badly, but only in the context of the game.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's entirely full of really some of the most supportive and wonderful people I've ever met.
It seems to be perhaps a running theme of that era, and maybe we haven't left it all together back then. I think it still continues with us, of this sort of balancing out between dark and light, you know, this gray kind of area. I'm thinking in that same time period, the Batman Begins, you know, that mm-hmm. Christopher Nolan trilogy came out, and you have, especially in the second movie, that whole good bad balance, you know, sure. it was really worked out. But in the first one, they make a big deal about masks, right? Like the mm-hmm. masks that we wear, and you know, these dual identities, and how you might go about treating ones, you know, and of course movies are reflections of the time period. And then, you know, like it's almost like a society was created and it's a global society. You know, everybody can play it, and it's like the culture that was forged through this game is very rapidly just doing what normal humans would do anyway.
There have been lots of studies. The in-game economy, there are economists who study it. The relationship building, it's all been studied extensively. And you're right. It is. And that's why when I talk about EVE Online with people, they'll be like, oh, so it's a video game. And I'm like, well, kind of. Yeah. it's a lot more than just a video game. To call it a hobby is still a little bit of a minimalization. It's a community. It's a hobby. It's a video game. It's a support system. I mean, even myself, when I was, you know, when I went through some, you know, pretty dark times in life, as we all do, you know, we retreat into these fantasy worlds to make ourselves feel better. The difference here is, unlike, you know, when we would do that with something like World of Warcraft or other MMOs, even, that it's, yeah, there are parts of the game that you play with other people, but the vast majority of the play is just you running around, looking at the back of your character's avatar as they kill monsters and gather herbs and whatever they do. In EVE Online, it's almost always, most of the vast majority of the gameplay is with other people. Mm-hmm. And you get to know these people. One of the times that EVE Online was in international news was after the attacks in Benghazi. There were the tech person there who in game was known as Vile Rat, and out of game his first name was Sean, but I don't remember him. I don't remember his last name. He was part of one of the biggest alliances, one of the biggest in game groups, and I knew him. And a lot of people knew him, like hundreds of thousands of people throughout the world knew this guy. And when he passed due to that terrible tragedy, like, the game almost came to a standstill. Like, there were, like, so many people just sort of went, just stopped doing what they were doing and just supported each other.
Curious about that. I mean, this is all fascinating. I think curiosity is saying too little. It's fascinating to think that this is truly a separate world that has just was created 20 years ago, you know, just 21 years ago. It was created then, and it seems that world seems to be affected by the real world more than the other way around. Mm-hmm. But what you're communicating is that the people who involve themselves in it, because I think also gamer is probably too short of a expression for somebody who plays EVE, right? I mean, it's
way it's too minimalist right? expression. Yeah. It is
a community member. I could put it that way.
Yeah.
That they do you think that they take what they do in EVE and bring it into the real world with them at all?
Sure, some people do. There's a used to be yearly, now it's every 18 months or so, convention in Iceland, and you'll often have talks there from people who started playing EVE Online, and because of what they did in game and how they learned how to manage people and deal with people, they got massive promotions at work. There's a whole economic side where I spent a not insignificant portion of my adult life working in personal finance, and you know, the in-game market, you can learn just about everything you need to know about the really like low level fundamentals about trading in securities by working in the in-game market. These organizations, a lot of them have absolutely have better technology infrastructure than any school I've ever worked at. Like this internet spaceship club game club that I'm in has better technology than the school I work for. It's crazy. So, yeah, I mean, and you know, just by networking and meeting people, certainly, and that's why it's more of a community than anything else. Or you'll just by by interacting with such a broad range of humanity in different countries, you just find out about things that you didn't know about before that you might enjoy doing. Like, you know, you'll be in a group with somebody and they'll be talking about their work in the real world. And you'll say, wait, that's a job? Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, that's a job. And I'm like, well, what do you need to do to get into that job? And they're like, well, you could just do this, this, and this. I mean, it's like, it's wild.
So it's great for cultural literacy. It seems like,
for you know, sure,
to learn other people that, and I guess the question we can end with, and I think this is a kind of a bring us back to the beginning of it, but is why did they make it? I, as you're saying these things, especially about the community building side of it, it's, this is also around the same time that social media is really starting to pick up
a little bit.
And when you compare the two, it's almost like the Eve online community can scoff and be like, Facebook, really?
Like Facebook, like, really? We've been doing that for years.
Right. Like we have, you know, like, oh, you might know that somebody checked in at Starbucks. Well, we know, you know, like.
Yeah, right. I set my alarm. Works,
you know,
like, I set my alarm clock for 3 a.m. so that I could wake up and log into my spaceship and shoot a Russian guy in his spaceship because they were invading where my internet spaceship friends live. Like,
it's like a different kind of relationship. And it's almost like using the internet. A friend of mine said to me a couple months ago, cause he was talking about, you know, how I use podcasting and I've connected with people that I would never have a reason to connect with before by doing this. And he gave me a really good compliment. He said, you're using the internet what it's intended for. Like, he's like, all these other, like, there's so many dark and creepy and just trashy places online that people congregate, or it's not even congregating. Like, you know, just social media especially has just turned into
toxic,
especially for young people, very toxic, or just like, here's another picture of my face and here's another picture of my face. And here's, you know, from 10 seconds later, here's another. And where it seems like in this very important time period of the early 2000s, the post 9/11 internet world, where this was a choice that was made. Why do you think? I mean, we know why Blizzard made World of Warcraft. It was just an extension of, you know, their existing games. But why did this company make Eve?
Yeah, so, you know, if we listen to the primary sources, which are the people who actually made it, they'll say that what they wanted to do was to make a world inside of a world. They wanted to make a place where it was kind of dark and scary, right? But they wanted it to be a world within a world. They wanted it to be a community within the greater global community. They wanted to make the sandbox. They wanted to make a sandbox for the world, right? In elementary school, we had this massive sandbox, and if you didn't have anybody to play with, you just go over to the sandbox and somebody's got a truck and you can help them build their little sand fort. And that is, in my experience, in everything I've heard and been being part of this game for almost 20 years, I firmly believe that they made this game as a tool, as a really, really good Second Life way for people to interact with each other and create this massive community around this hobby that they enjoy. And I think they knew they were doing that because I think they always envisioned this idea that the players control the entirety of the story. Mm-hmm. No other game does that. World of Warcraft has a story. Eve sort doesn't really have a story. I mean, there's narrative, there's lore, but, you know, there have been two history books written about it, called Empires of Eve, and it talks about the struggles between player groups to control chunks of the in-game space. And I firmly believe that Crowd Control Productions made this game as a second life, as a place somebody could go and spend as much or as little time as they wanted and have it be something that's not their house. Starbucks used to say, Starbucks' original mission was to make this third place. It's not work, it's not home, it's this third place. Well, I think that was also CCP, Crowd Control Productions, I think that was their goal. They wanted to make a third place where you could hang out and you could interact with all sorts of people around common goals. And I think they did a great job of it. I mean, it's 20 years that this game's been going. Another game. There's no other game. There's no other game that has not had a sequel and has just been going on the same server with the same code base for 20 years.
Racking my brain, thinking, I'm like, well, have humans always needed this kind of escape? And I guess I don't think
community.
So.
We like our community,
but we also I feel like we've built upon. And I like what you said, you know, paraphrasing Starbucks, and yeah, I didn't expect that, but I mean, that's. You know, like the market revolution, for example, in the early 19th century brought people into seeing their home differently. They're like, my home is not just where I sleep or work all day long. It's my escape from work. Like, I, this is my haven. This is my place to unwind and enjoy family time and things like that. And, literature, I think, came from that. I think novels and creative arts in that way was an escape. You know, we don't really have, it's by the end of that century that like really science fiction and fantasy was being created. And you can tell from, you know, the masters of that they were doing it as a way to give themselves another, you know, another world, you know, that real world building style of storytelling. I think that contributes to the success of Eve.
Sure.
And I really am impressed and fascinated by the way you said that it's just, I mean, they are so willing to just let the people do their own thing and not involve themselves. And I'm sure it's definitely a tempting thing to do is get in there and be like, no, you know, you're going to not do that. We're going to do what you want or we want. But I almost feel like this is meeting the need of the 21st century.
Oh, I agree.
Person, like home is not always enough. You know, it gets us away from work, it gets us away from school, it gets us away from our neighbors, whatever. But maybe that's still not enough. Maybe because of just the constant bombardment of information that we're under, that we want some control over that, and say, all right. I'm not just going to let people, because I'm thinking of, you know, immediately after, including 9/11 2001, it was just, you couldn't even watch a TV program, especially the news, without four different sides of, you know, all sides of your screen with just different information just thrown at you. It was overwhelming. This gives you control and your own agency, your own ability to be in there.
And I think that, humans are storytellers, right? Yeah. We like to tell each other stories. We like to create stories. We like to think about stories. You know, we like to step out of our day to day. That's why I read Tolkien as a kid. That's why we play video games. That's why we read novels. That's why we watch television. And what makes EVE Online unique, different, and just so incredibly special is in World of Warcraft, I'm playing the stories that those brilliant storytellers are telling me, right? And they're fantastic. Their storylines are brilliant, and I love them. In EVE Online, I'm making the story with hundreds of thousands of other people.
Yeah.
Right? The overarching story, the narrative is constructed by the actions and the agency of the players. And it's all interconnected. You know, I could be, you know, the same ore, the same minerals that I mine in one area of the world could be used to build a spaceship that blows up, that blows me up later on down the line. It's all interconnected. It's stories based on people, and it's not, that's why the books that are written are history books, because it's the history of the players. It's the history of the game.
Yeah.
World of Warcraft has a story, and it's a great story, but it doesn't have a history. Whereas EVE Online, the story is the history, because history is made by people.
Right.
And people make the history of this game.
So this is a lot more advanced than The Sims, I would say.
Oh, significantly.
I would hope so. I mean, and that just popped in my head too. I'm like, there's another example, same time period, of people living vicariously through a computerized version of themselves, oftentimes, especially when they could make their own selves.
Well, traveling wasn't safe anymore, right? I mean, in the 70s, in all through the 80s and 90s, traveling was safe. You could go anywhere. As an American, you could go anywhere. After 9/11, that changed.
Yeah. People really did have a different perspective. That's another way of putting it, too, is of the safe place being your computer, you know, until that gets infiltrated. And it seems like this the EVE world seems to be very self monitoring by what you're describing, that it's policed by the people in the game.
There have been some absolute terrible humans that I've met in EVE Online. I'm not saying it's all sunshine, daisies and puppies, right? Because people are people, but the vast majority of the people, and even some of the most like brutal and ferocious, will absolutely blow up your spaceship. I can't even tell you how many times I've been minding my own business in that game and somebody just shows up and blows me up for no reason whatsoever, and then they send me a voice chat and are like, hey, good job, man, and they send me enough in-game money to replace my ship, right? It's about the interaction. It's about the community.
No, I love it. I love just the world's colliding, like, and like you said, like, the game has a history. Every single person on Earth has a history. Every single person has a story. And so when these stories all, you know, so that person showing up out of nowhere and blowing you out of, he's probably, maybe he or she had a bad day, you know, at work, and just
or not to get it out, you know, or it's just that's what they do, right?
Yeah, it's just their vicious streak, and they're like, all right, I got it out of my system. But Mike, it's been so much fun talking about this. I gotta look into it. I think the last question I have for you is there a reason why it's called EVE? Is it just a nice short easy name for the
so there is the basic premise of the game itself is that this is 30,000 years in the future. Humanity discovered this wormhole thing called the EVE Gate, you know, many, many thousands of years before. So humanity discovers this thing called the EVE Gate. They launch through this EVE Gate and, they split into several different cultures but they still had access to it for, you know, several thousand years so they could go back to Earth. But then the EVE Gate blew up. And so then it was kind of this dark age. Where different cultures evolved and developed until they all sort of raised up and found space travel again, and then started shooting each other with spaceships.
That's a pretty good. I like the story's getting better and better. I think the only thing that'd be more satisfying, we'll never know if it's true or not, but imagine if 30,000 years from now, everything that you've done in the last 20 is exactly.
That would be crazy.
Accurate.
That would be so crazy.
I just blew your mind because, like, you're actually. Wouldn't that be incredible if this is
even bringing like a different take on the last Starfighter, right?
Like, exactly. These guys, this crowd control, they're like, maybe they're sent from 30,000.
They're time travelers, and they're like,
okay, we need to create our world, so let's get to it.
Or is it the Matrix?
Yeah. Oh. Hey, another time, same thing, you know, same era. It's like our relationship with the technology. Okay, it's been wonderful talking to you about
this. Great. And, I'm sorry we didn't talk more about World of Warcraft. I mean,
I think it talks about itself quite a bit. I mean, I don't think EVE Online has a whole South Park, series based on it. So, it has its place in pop culture, but it's been wonderful talking to you. So, thank you, Mike, for joining the EPS podcast, where everything, including EVE Online and World of Warcraft, are primary sources. We'll talk to you next time.
The Everything is a Primary Source project is a collaborative, open source digital archive of oral history based on reactions and relationships to popular culture. Each entry into the archive begins with a conversation recorded during one of our Your History Through Pop Culture exhibits, also known as podcast karaoke. These are held at a variety of different venues and can be booked for your school, library, museum, or business to be carried out in person or virtually. The next step is to post the primary source in its appropriate category at everything-history.com and supplement it with a short essay contextualizing the book, movie, album, show, toy, game, gadget, or whatever else might be the subject. This will usually be done by us, but these essays could be your way of collaborating. Each recording typically covers just one or two of the 9 critical thinking questions that are asked in order to decide what an artifact tells us about time and place. This leaves room for teachers and their students from all over to contribute by recording their own thoughts on the subject until all of the questions are answered. You can even take part without typing or talking. Each entry will have a space for you to include your pictures of related primary sources that help make the time period and place in question clear. Teachers and their classes are able to use the archives as reliable secondary sources while the entries are under construction, and absolutely when they're completed. While some topics might be reserved for older students, the Everything is a Primary Source project will always have something for everyone. The Everything is a Primary Source project promotes history, media, and digital literacies, cultural appreciation and collaboration between people of different ages, geography, and backgrounds. Ultimately, it demonstrates how fun it is to learn about history through pop culture. Start your collaborative journey today at everything-history.com.